Hello, everyone. I'm Dana Perino, along with Judge Jeanine Pirro, Richard Fowler, Jesse Waters, and Greg Gutfeld. It's 5 o'clock in New York City, and this is The Five. One of the most controversial Americans of our time, O.J. Simpson, dead at 76 after a battle with prostate cancer. He's regarded as one of the greatest running backs of all time and used his sports fame to turn himself into a household name. He starred in Hertz commercials and many movies. But everything changed the night of June 12, 1994, when Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ronald Goldman were found brutally stabbed to death in the courtyard outside her home in L.A. O.J. charged with their deaths. He was tried and eventually acquitted in the trial of the century.
This point is, it is a pursuit, and unfortunately it has a lot of mitigating circumstances because of the high profile of the proposed suspect that's inside the vehicle, which could possibly be and appears to be at this time O.J. Simpson.
It was the most dramatic and heart-stopping moment of this trial. In front of the jury, O.J. Simpson tried on the gloves prosecutors say he was wearing the night he murdered his ex-wife. He tried to show the gloves do not fit.
It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson.
O.J. was sued separately by the Goldmans and the Browns in civil court for wrongful death, where a jury found him liable. The Goldman family speaking out about his death, saying, "The only thing I have to say is it's just further reminder of Ron being gone all these years. It's no great loss to the world. It's a further reminder of Ron's being gone." Judge Jeanine, I mean, it was interesting to listen to some of the younger producers today who didn't, you know, live through it and know about it. They might have watched the documentary about it or the that show that was on it. But for those of us who lived through it, and I'm sure from your lens as a lawyer and a judge, it was
fascinating. Well, I was one of the talking heads.
So that's why we have you here today.
Yes. I was a sitting DA at the time, and I'll never forget June 12th. I had just been elected the DA in Westchester County in New York. And one of the guys, I have my whole office at my house for a barbecue. One of the guys came out, he said, "Boss, O.J. Simpson is in a white Bronco and the police are chasing him." So a few of us went in to the kitchen and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And then we realized, we went into the den because there were a lot more of us, that he was supposed to show up at the police department and turn himself in. He refused to do so. So, you know, we're all these prosecutors together and saying, you know, this consciousness of guilt, this is flight. But what we didn't realize that night was that this was the beginning of one of the most sensational trials, if not the most sensational trial of the century. The media was fascinated. The public was fascinated. The public had never seen a courtroom. They had never seen a trial. People would run home from work and say, "I've got to watch the trial. I've got to see what was going on." And I and so many others, I mean, I stayed as DA and I was a judge before that, but I didn't go into television from there, but so many people got their jump into television from this. But one of the most significant parts of this is the United States and people in this country were all involved in this shared experience of what the criminal justice system is like and the new DNA. What did it mean? How significant was it? What about, you know, the PCR? What about all of the other different types? And then there was the undercurrent of racism in this trial that, because of Mark Furman, was brought to a head. And there were so many people who were very critical of the decision by the jury here in this trial that ran for 9 months. It ran for 9 months. I mean, this was people made careers out of this. And the jury made the decision in less than 4 hours. And I remember being on live television at the time, and they came in and focused on all of us. And, you know, this was a jury of 8 blacks and 2 mixed race and, I believe, 2 whites. And there were many who believed that because of the racism, because of the issues that Mark Furman was involved in, that the Goldmans and that Nicole Brown Simpson were literally paying for the sins of the fathers. And there has always been this question about, is he guilty or isn't he? And, you know, for those of us who understood the forensics and the DNA and all of the other stuff going on, You know, the idea that the glove didn't fit, give me a break. The glove was covered with blood. The blood shrunk. Of course he couldn't get his hands in the gloves. But, you know, you accept the decision of the jury, and of course he got burnt later in the civil case where he barely paid any of the money. But the public fascination with this, it began a whole new line of people with crime stories and court TV, and all of us who love this and made this part of our careers, we were happy that from now on we had juries who understood what DNA was. They understood direct circumstantial evidence. Anyway,
I could ask you 20,000 more questions, but Richard Fowler, from your perspective.
Listen, I want to pick up where the judge left off, because I remember this case. Well, I was in the third grade when this verdict came out, and I remember sitting in class when the teacher played it on a red radio, and I remember the reaction that I had, because to the judge's point, this case was rife with race, because there was so much. I mean, to understand the prism of the O.J. Simpson trial, you have to understand what was happening in L.A. That time. Right. 2 years prior to this, there was the Rodney King beating that was caught on tape in 1991. Those four officers got a change of venue to Simi Valley, and they were acquitted after beating Rodney King. And so there was a just tension in the air. And if you go back, and we were talking to producers in the green room before the show, and like, you could literally watch the footage and see two Americans, people who were neighbors, and black people saying this is great and white people crying at the same time watching this verdict, despite the evidence, just because of where we were as a country and just how rife the racial tension was around the LAPD. And I think that was sort of made worse by the Mark Furman tapes that had come out in the middle of the trial. And this is just an interesting moment in history. But to the judge's point, too, it also created the cable news cycle, the 24-hour media, all this idea that you can follow a case, and these true crime stories, that this narrative that we now live in was created by this case, by the O.J. Simpson trial. And here we are, a lot of years later.
Here we are, prime time.
Just a little bit older than Richard. I was 16 when this happened. I used to come back from practice and watch the case. And I do remember exactly what you said and realizing how divided the country was. I think as a white guy, I was like, wow, this guy's a killer. He just got away with murder. The evidence is obvious. And then you see images of Black America celebrating. And I'm not saying all Black America felt that OJ was innocent. I'm saying that when you see people cheering and then explaining that, good, you know, finally we have someone who looks like us use the justice system in their favor. And it was almost like a wake-up call. People realized, wait a second, you know, maybe this system isn't always about justice. Maybe it's about money. And O.J. Simpson was so wealthy, and to the judge's point, I finally started admiring these defense lawyers. These guys, they called the dream team. You pay these guys so much money. And it was almost like they had superpowers. I was dazzled with Johnny Cochran. I was just hanging on every word he said. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, not only did the glove shrink because of the blood, Judge, he had advised OJ to stop taking his arthritis medication. Mm. So his knuckles had swollen. And so, and then you're looking at the DNA evidence and you're looking, wait a second, this stuff can get contaminated. And thankfully, years later, the chain of custody has now gotten perfect where you don't even let anybody breathe near this thing. I just want to just say my heart goes out to the Goldman family, the Brown family. It does look like the estate now owes them almost $100 million because OJ, I don't know how he did it. He avoided somehow not paying these people almost a dime. I hope they collect.
Are you going to say how old you were, Greg?
I wasn't born. So it's nice to hear this from all these old people. Now, I got to say, this one really hurts. It's funny. I always think of that car rental commercial when I'm running through the airport after stabbing two people. Did you know that Steve Ducey's wife was in that commercial? She's the one who tosses the car keys to OJ. I think she really dodged a bullet, or at least a knife. I think OJ's real crime was making Jeffrey Toobin famous. A little stuff, some facts about OJ. He left behind five children and other people he didn't murder. He dies holding the record for the average rushing yards per game and most stabs in a Brentwood driveway. Do we really know he's dead, though? Maybe we should ask an L.A. jury. They might declare him alive. Who's going to search for the real killer now? I hear Jussie Smollett is free. He's been searching for those other Trumpers. Maybe he could pack this in. And then one note to Khloe Kardashian. You may have lost a dad, but you still have two moms. So now, justice, my lesson here is justice is wholly fallible if it can be throttled from outside forces. You can't get a fair trial, and that wasn't a fair trial to the victims. So you need to apply that lesson to now. We are in a political and a social and emotional climate where getting a fair trial is hard to get. And as much as you hate Derek Chauvin, right? You still know that trial wasn't fair, thanks to the documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis. And Michael Avenatti agrees that there's no chance for a fair trial for Trump in New York, or else the proponents wouldn't mind if you moved it outside of New York. So what I learned, it's not about the evidence in the trial, it's where you present it. It's not about what's inside the courtroom, it's about what's outside the courtroom and how it applies pressure to the judge and the jury, whether it's the threat of public chaos or media outrage. The OJ trial showed us what would and what could come when the court of public opinion trumps the actual court of law. That jury made a political decision, an emotional decision, but it certainly wasn't a legal one.
Love and justice.
If I could make a programming note tonight, we have Cato Kalin on Jesse Waters'
Prime Time. That's a great booking. All right.
A thump on the wall.
O.J. Simpson, dead at 76 years old today. Ahead, President Biden hobnobbing with celebrities at a state dinner while Americans skip meals to afford housing.
Here's to getting better with age.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just call him Joe Antoinette. The White House rolling out the red carpet for a swanky state dinner with the Japanese prime minister, while regular Americans are feeling the pain from yet another devastating inflation report. Washington got to schmooze with big tech billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Hollywood celebs like Robert De Niro. Bill and Hillary were walking around like they own the place, even though they're never getting the keys back. And boy, was it a feast. The elites gorging on house-cured salmon, dry-aged ribeye steak, and fava beans. And while they got to fill their bellies, a new report claims that an alarming number of Americans are skipping meals just so that they can afford their home. And this has got to sting. A voter panel on Biden's favorite cable news show, Morning Joe, is slamming Bidenomics.
We hear from voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, undecided voters. Here are their answers when they're asked about how President Biden is doing on the economy. Take a listen.
Please raise your hand if you think President Trump's policies on the economy would be better for your family personally. Raise your hand. All right, so that is everybody.
I feel like he doesn't even take accountability.
When he's talking about the economy doing stellar, he's talking about the stock market. He's not looking at homelessness or joblessness. He's not, at Adrian's point, thinking about how much it costs to go to the grocery store. And he's gaslighting literally everyone in the process.
But Biden's defenders are doing their best to brainwash voters into thinking that the economy is doing great.
Social media and the misrepresentation, disinformation, all of those things are out there, and that's the battle that we have to fight, and we've got to do a better job of fighting it more effectively.
We just got breaking news. The consumer price index increased at a faster than expected pace last month, a signal that inflation remains stubbornly high.
Okay, Jesse, I'll start with you. Even the undecided voters on that panel with Morning Joe were complaining and basically saying Joe's in denial. He doesn't understand how much we're hurting. Do you think that Morning Joe and Mika were trying to send a message to Biden? They know he watches every morning.
It depends on if they knew what they were going to hear first. I don't know if they knew what the answers were first, but that looked like to me the first time they'd interviewed anybody besides themselves. Mm-hmm. We have Johnny.
Now, Johnny goes out to the streets and he gets the pulse of the people. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've gotten the pulse. I think their only pulse is the studio, and that's not going to cut it. Disinformation, they actually put out a report that said inflation is a good thing last year. And the expectation is that inflation is going to cool to a point where he's going to come and have a little runway going into November. But that's not going to happen. So I have a little advice for the libs and Richard. Because you can't bring inflation down fast enough, you have to say this. You have to say Donald Trump will make inflation worse. You have to say Donald Trump will let Russia just rip through Ukraine and make Putin's price hike even bigger. You have to say Trump's tax cuts are going to make inflation worse. You're going to say Trump's greedy CEO buddies are going to keep gouging you. And this billionaire doesn't even know what the price of milk is anyway. So don't fall for it. That's what they have to do. Now, why did I just say that? Because I am so bored of saying the same thing for 4 years.
Okay. All right, Richard, would you like to answer that? You know, Jim Clyburn says, you know, that people are in denial, that they're not really seeing how Bidenomics is helping them. I mean, people are every day at the grocery store seeing it.
Look, I think there's a couple of things. I agree with Jesse's point that there is a clear contrast to be made between the current occupant of the White House and the former occupant of the White House, right? I think when you hear Donald Trump talk about the economy that he wants for the American people, he reminisces about 2018 or 2017, but you rarely ever hear him talk about 2025 or 2026 or 2027 or the plan, what he's going to do when he wins. He just reminisces about the past. And so I think all those arguments are true, Jesse. Thanks for that. But I also
think they're going to work because everybody remembers that inflation was low during the Trump administration.
But I also think that there has to be some contrition from this White House and saying, listen, the inflation's not exactly where we want it to be, right? But here are the things we're doing to make your life easier at home. One thing that we're doing is this. We are capping the cost of late fees on credit cards to $8 a month, which means that will save the American people and working families up to $12 billion every year. We've already capped insulin payments to $35 a month for senior citizens. Not to mention the fact that we have the longest sprint of job growth. We've seen the GDP grow. And while you're not feeling it yet, these impacts are coming your way because we're working on it and we're actively working on it. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, we have a candidate that's talking about the 2020 election or how the economy was doing in 2017. Or like you said, he doesn't know the price of milk or the price of eggs or the price of gas or the price of anything for that matter.
You know what, Dana? Richard is saying that, you know, they're just not feeling those benefits yet. Here's the difference. You go to the supermarket every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, just if you look at the increases are incredible for the stuff that you really need. And then so if you're at the grocery store and you see people who are looking at their cart and they're like, I guess I have to put this back. Right. That's a terrible feeling for anybody. And if that's happening all across the country, they do have a serious problem. A couple of things on this. One, who is the White House's powerhouse communicator on the economy? They don't have one. On any sort, they put Pete Buttigieg out a lot. He's not able to talk about this, right? The press secretary is not convincing people. John Kirby has his hands full with national security issues. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris is not calming people down about inflation. Certainly the president isn't. It's the number one issue. They don't have anybody out there talking about immigration or inflation. I can't figure it out. I don't know what's going on. Bernstein's pretty good. And if you have him on TV, believe me, he will just keep talking. You will never get a word in edgewise, and he will try to bang you over the head with it.
Good.
But the other thing is on the undecided voters panel, what's super interesting about it is MSNBC didn't do those interviews. It was separate. It was Mark Halperin did that himself, and he did it on a thing called Two Way. You can check out. He's going to do several more of these because nobody else is doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So he's out there saying, okay, I'm just going to have these focus groups, and you can take them or leave them. A lot of people know Mark Halperin from the political world. I'm sure I think he used to appear on Morning Joe. And what was really stunning, we didn't show you, is Mika and Joe's face, Mika's face in particular, after they hear from these independent voters,
yes,
and it's almost as
upset.
If they start to realize, like, oh, my gosh, we got a problem.
Yeah. And, you know, Greg, the amazing thing is Ron Klain, former chief of staff, I mean, no one knows the story better than he does. He says he's sick and tired of Joe Biden going to cut a ribbon at a bridge a couple times a week. He ought to go into a supermarket.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was going to credit MSNBC for actually running that. But then I realized they probably didn't even know what they were running.
They had no idea.
They were so surprised. I'm surprised, you know, Joe didn't have a cardiac arrest, because that is what happens when the media, you know, loosens its grip on the narrative. You actually hear the truth. I'm sure they had no idea. I'm sure they were devastated. I'm sure that Mika was thinking, oh, my God, if that process is possible. It just killed my talking points. I was going to give them credit. But here is the problem with the Dems, the people who have the power over the purse. Money, as it grows, has diminishing returns. If something costs $20 and it now costs $40, that matters to you. If you need $200 to cover the cost of what cost $100 before, that hurts. But when Biden hears $4 trillion instead of $2 trillion, it means nothing to him. This is why a family struggling with food, struggling with food bills, and keeps struggling, Biden can happily bribe art history majors with billions of our tax money in loan theft, because to him, it's just pennies.
Okay, up next, radical Rashida Tlaib is condemning Fox News, but not Death to America.
You know, when I take the bike out like this.
Pro-Hamas lunatics raging in America. The anti-Israel agitators depriving the Senate of their lunch after shutting down their cafeteria this week. And Squad Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is flat out refusing to condemn a group of protesters in her district who chanted death to America while at a Ramadan rally. But there was something that she was willing to get mad about.
At a rally in your district, people were chanting death to America. Do you condemn? But do you condemn chants of death to America?
I don't talk to people that use racist trolls.
Why can't you just say whether or not you condemn people chanting death to America? Why are you afraid to talk to Fox?
Fox News is not using racist tropes towards my community is what Fox News is about, and I don't talk to Fox News.
Is death to America racist?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, Dana. She cites these racist tropes without examples. Is it possible she conflates being anti-terror with anti-Muslim, and that that's actually the racist trope?
I'm not in Rashida's head.
Oh, thank God
goodness.
For that. Although you probably could fit there.
maybe that's a good one. The squad went from being this very proud, we'll take on anybody, to like, oh my gosh, we won't talk to Fox News. And I think, again, as we said yesterday, we have more Democrats and independents that watch this show, or this network, excuse me, this entire channel, than all the others. So it's a great place to be. And if, look, Hillary's there. You know what, Hillary? Here's what I think. And she could have had an opportunity. Instead, we're all just able to look at this and go, okay, she doesn't want to answer about people in her district chanting death to America. You know, it's chilling when you hear that audio and see the video. We've played it because I think we need to know. We can't bury our heads in the sand like this is actually happening. You made a good point the other day, believe it or not, about little Gazans everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Of the problem of not having a melting pot and not being cohesive and not wanting to be there. So she missed an opportunity. But I have to tell you, I admire that Hillary Vaughn.
Yeah.
She is tenacious. Yeah. And I was talking about young women like speaking with their strong voice, and she's got it.
Yeah, you know, Peter Ducey could learn something from her. Judge, could it be a badge of honor if Rashida refuses to talk to you? Because, like, it makes you think, who does she want to talk to?
Well, it's not a badge of honor, because if she truly believed that, you know, her mission was an important one, she would try to get followers anywhere. I mean, what does she think we're going to do to her tape? I mean, you know, it's an opportunity to talk to people. And, you know, I spoke to a congresswoman today and I said, does Rashida Tlaib still have the Palestinian flag outside of her office? And she said this to me in real time. There's a Palestinian flag and the United States flag is in the corner.
Yep.
I mean, look, here's the bottom line. She says she doesn't endorse or she won't condemn it. When what they're talking about is death to America and to the whole system. If the system is so rotten in America because we support Israel, well, Rashida is a part of the system. Doesn't she have an obligation to even defend herself and what she does? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the inability to condemn them shows me that her allegiance is to other than America, which is then corroborated by the Palestinian flag in the halls of Congress in the United States. And, you know, it's interesting. The January 6th people who were in jail, I don't know if any of them talked about death to America or death to the system.
I'm shocked that flag's allowed in there.
I am too. And she said to me, Congresswoman Claudia Tenney, she sent it to me. She said, Janine, this is real time this afternoon.
What do you think, Richard?
Look, I think you can condemn somebody saying death to America. And what we did see happen, didn't get as much reporting as this, but the Dearborn mayor and the city council condemned the comments that were made in their city. But I think instead of focusing on one member of Congress, it's important to focus on the fact that we are a democracy. And you can, in this country, say, I have a problem with the president's positioning on Israel, and that's okay. You can say, I have a problem with how...
It's not a very good chant, though.
I'm not talking about the chant. I'm talking about there's people who have a philosophical problem with how the United States is supporting Israel. And in America, you're allowed to say that, right? In the Gaza, you're not, right? If you're under the Hamas regime, you're not allowed to say that. And I think it's very important to focus on that in this moment where the Middle East is moving closer and closer to conflict. There's a report that came out of Reuters today where Germany and Russia and other European countries are saying, urging restraint as Iran and Israel move closer and closer to possibly going to some sort of military action between the two of them. So in this moment, as we talk about the importance of a democracy, where this election will be about protecting the democracy, the ideal, the foundation of that democracy is no matter what side you're on, you have the ability to say, I disagree with this president. I disagree with his policies. I disagree with the former president. I disagree with his policies. That's what makes this country great, period.
You know, in the green room, Jesse, you said, you know, I was watching the movie Barbie last night and I was thinking about America Ferrera. How is she holding up when she hears these chants? And I thought, you know, Jesse, that was amazing.
Who's America Ferrera?
She played the mother.
Okay. Again, I did not watch Barbie, unlike some people at this table, some men at this table.
Thank you.
Okay, you shouldn't be owning to it. I'm feeling charitable today, and I'm just going to give her some advice. You either just say, yeah, I condemn, and you get in the elevator. How hard is that? Or if you don't want to engage, you don't say anything. Silent treatment. Then we're not doing it on the five. Or if you're feeling a little fun, you can big girl her. You say, hey, Hillary, come here. Give me the mic. You know, they're not paying you enough at Fox. You're everywhere. All right? You need a drink, Hillary. You know, just have a little fun with it. She could have done 1,000 different things. She did the wrong thing. And she didn't even have the evidence. What racist tropes?
Yeah.
And then she couldn't even spit her words out cleanly. She is a mess.
All right. On that note, let's move on. Ahead, libraries are turning into drug-infested sex dens.
Perfect world.
I think.
Libraries are no longer safe in Joe Biden's America. My once favorite place to immerse myself in Dana's reading list has transformed into rowdy drug and hookup dens. Across the country, the ladies who tell you to shush have witnessed everything from public sex, people shooting up, and even assault. It's so bad in San Francisco, librarians are now demanding security guards be stationed at every branch. One poor woman found herself standing between a half-dressed man wielding a sharp letter opener and a group of preschoolers. I'm going to go to you first, Richard.
I knew it was coming, but I'm ready.
What is happening?
I'll tell you what's happening because I have the backstory for this one. Those workers you saw there are members of SEIU Local 1021. They're currently bargaining a new collective bargaining agreement.
Oh,
and they're asking for more security in their libraries. But while that's happening in San Francisco, what's also happening in San Francisco is you're seeing a decrease in crime. Car break-ins are down 51%. Gun violence is down 38%. Property crimes are down 14%. Robbery is down 18%. Overall crime is down 32%. So the narrative that crime is just rampant and widespread is actually not matching up to the statistics.
May I ask you one question? No. Is it down from last year or down from 2019?
It's down from the pandemic highs. I'll give you that. Okay. I don't get me wrong. I think at the height of the pandemic and right after coming out of the pandemic, crime was at an all-time high. What we're seeing happening now is crime is decreasing all across the country. In San Francisco,
that's not true.
In Chicago, in Atlanta,
it's
in
not
Philly,
your fault,
in New York.
It's not your fault,
name
Richard.
The place.
It's not your fault.
According to the FBI. The data says it.
No, do you really believe that?
I do believe the FBI.
It's not. Richard, you haven't been watching our show.
The FBI data has been revealed to be flawed. They did a comprehensive piece in the Washington Examiner where they completely debunked it and showed that the system that was being used was abandoned by cities because it was too complicated, and that even the FBI just stopped tabulating crime. So they started estimating, and now they're finding out that when they talk to the victims in terms of like things like robberies, it's up 30% rather than down 10%.
This data is also from the this is from the San Francisco Police Department as well, just so we're clear.
But here's the problem, that the stat reporting is so onerous. The local police are not doing it. It's just like police.
This is from the local police, though.
But what I'm telling, first of all, why is everybody leaving California? Why are homes down 20% in San Francisco? Why? Because there's no crime there? Everybody's leaving the state because it's a hellhole. Because people are shooting up in libraries, having sex in libraries, and beating each other up. You got someone who's half-dressed with a knife and preschoolers right there. Let me tell you something. The thing that's wrong with this society is that we got a bunch of liberal leftist progressives who know nothing. I don't know what makes them think that letting criminals out and let them act out their hate and their violence and their sex and their drugs in a public library reduces racism. These people are bonkers.
Bonkers, I say. Dana?
I mean, if only San Francisco could just hire a whole bunch of security guards called police and then actually enforce the crimes and then reinforce the police and what they do. It was one of the great cities of the world. I used to love going there. I know you grew up there and people think of it fondly. But when you think of going on vacation right now, does it ever enter your mind to think, I would love to go to San Peter, we said, let's go to San Francisco. No, we say, let's go to Nashville. Let's go to Charleston. Maybe we should go to Miami. How about Key West? Maybe we should go to Dallas. Nobody is wanting to take a vacation there. In fact, people are being forced to go to conventions there because they're under contracts.
Right.
Look, I hope that the librarians get what they want. They deserve to be protected. But the other problem is all these libraries all across the country, people aren't going there to check out Charlotte's Web as I did. And you could have it for 7 days. They are going there to get free internet. Sometimes there's free food and drink, like on several times a month, and they're able to hide, and they also are having sex.
Oh, and you can use the restroom for free.
That's true.
Greg?
I don't care if the libraries aren't safe for kids. Did you hear that they moved the book, My Trans Dad Can Twerk, from the kids section to teens? That's the real crime, Dana. I would gladly risk being assaulted rather than deny my child the right, you know, to read, to hear a drag queen read Billy Likes Butt Plugs during Pride Month. Here, look.
What?
To
what?
Your point, Dana.
Yep.
Isn't it amazing how the effort to reduce the oppressive presence of order ends up increasing the militarized response? It's the false compassion, which is directed towards criminality, gives way to the reality of lawlessness, which then ends up as a police state. A police state doesn't arrive in a society that has laws. The most lawless countries in the world are the ones with government-backed machine gunners on every corner.
Mm-hmm. Well, try said. To check out a book when a guy's pointing a machine gun at you.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I think what book you're going to check out. Not Greg's. Coming up.
Richard's either.
How dare you, Richard. Get your ass off the set right now. The four most dreaded words you can hear on an airplane.
See. Won't you come and we can stare at the stars and look at the comics for the roof of my car.
You know, I spend a lot of time thinking.
Even on a jet plane.
Welcome back. It's the four most dreaded words on a flight. Will you switch seats? Sadly, these annoying requests are on the rise, and they're causing some uncomfortable conversations. Dana.
Well, I have a theory about this. Okay, first of all,
let's hear it.
The only time I've ever really asked for this was if Peter and I could sit together. But I will never ask somebody if they'll move unless it's a better deal for them. like, are you going to move from a middle seat to an aisle seat if you switch with me? And I'll sit with Peter. Like, that I would do. Is it an even trade? You have to take that into account. And also, who would I have to sit next to? Because are they eating with their mouth open? Are they? Do they have their shoes off? Like, there's all of that. The other thing is, sometimes you don't need to sit with the people you're traveling with. Just put your AirPods in and be quiet.
Mm.
Sorry, Peter.
Greg.
Wow. And you met him on a plane.
Sometimes.
Imagine if you had that same logic.
No, I love to sit with him. I do.
I think we learned
something. I even sat in coach for him.
This is why I only fly private. No, I'm kidding.
I'm going. By the way, I'm going on a little trip next week for a couple of days. Yeah, so this will be on my radar for a little R&R. I will swap seats depending on what they're willing to barter for. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see that movie with Robert Redford, Indecent Proposal?
Yeah.
So come up with a list of options, and it has to be an upgrade, as you say. This is not going to be a – well, I'm not trading 50-50, so you're going to have to, like – you're going to have to try really hard to please me.
Yep.
Judge Janine.
Oh, yeah.
Well, first of all, I would never ask anyone if they could trade seats.
How about if they asked you to trade seats?
Huh?
How about if they asked you?
If they asked me, probably not. Probably not. I mean, really. I mean, there's so much that goes into your getting a seat. It's when you decided to get the ticket. You pay more for a particular seat. You pick one ahead of time. You know, everybody needs to be responsible for themselves. And, you know, it's like this airplane lunacy. It's starting to be like road rage. You know, you see people fighting with each other over seats. I don't like to get involved at all.
So you just put your AirPods in and ignore it.
Yeah, I put my big bows on, and I'm like reading.
Jesse.
I was on a flight with Emma and our two young children, and luckily,
I was hands doing?
Seated away from them.
Oh,
and
was that planned?
Emma goes, ask the guy if he can switch seats. So I disingenuously asked the guy. I looked him dead in the eyes, and I go, she couldn't see me. I go, would you like to switch seats? The guy said, sure, as hell you blew it. That was a lovely flight.
I do think there should be a kids section on the plane, though. I'm a big believer
in that. Oh, that is another topic.
But that's another topic for another day. Right now, one more thing's up next.
If you don't find my baby, come on back to Chicago.
Here's to getting better with age.
Time now for one more thing. Look, if New York City doesn't get it together, we could end up like Australia with our subway system. Check out what happened here. This horse in Sydney, Australia, was seen stirring up trouble. He was at the train station. Imagine if you saw that in the subway. You think you have it bad in New York? Look at what they're dealing with in Sydney.
He had a job interview. Look at the coat.
It was all suited up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Like
no one pushed that horse in front of the train, did they? No,
nope.
They did not. New York, look out. Judge.
Okay, to heaven to hold, so long as you're holding the right hand. Watch this case of mistaken identity out of Florida, where a new bride exits the wedding hand in hand with her hubby.
Oh,
except the man whose hand she grabs wasn't her hubby.
They didn't even look alike.
Not to worry, though. She went back for the actual groom, and everyone had a good laugh at her expense.
And it's all on tape.
That's
Frank.
Right.
They got divorced a year later.
So many decisions after that.
Tonight, oh, we got a big one. Roseanne Barr,
whoa,
Jeff Dye, Emily Campagno, and Tyrus. It's going to be fun. Let's do this, huh?
Animals
haven't done this in a while. Oh, this is fun.
Animals
oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is great. Emperor penguins, cliff diving.
Oh, wow.
Look at this.
Oh,
this is good. They all got there, and they're all waiting to go. And they're all half of them are terrified, but there they go. They're jumping.
Wait a minute. Okay. Wait a minute. Why?
Because
they have to migrate.
They swim away, and then they come back. But this is something they like to do.
Slow-mo. Wow.
Yeah.
It's that time of year.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's incredible, huh?
They really belly flop,
too. Where
is
this?
This is in the Antarctica. Not the Uncle Artica.
Oh, my God.
That's a good one, Greg.
Just thank
amazing.
You. By the way, this is the first of its kind footage, courtesy of National Geographic, who took the footage via drone.
Oh, I love it. They got some.
Speaking of drones, Dana, look who's next.
Oh, yes.
I will be in Fort Myers so over the week and get it together. There we are. Come see me at the Barnes & Noble Saturday. I'll sign books and take photos.
Then we'll be in Beach Haven, New Jersey, Vero Beach, Florida, Mendham, New Jersey. We got New Jersey covered, and then we're sold out in Yorba Linda. Tonight, Jesse Waters primetime, Cato Kaelin.
Amazing.
At 8 o'clock.
What does he look like now?
Same.
He does not.
Same exact look.
That's 30 years ago.
He doesn't age.
But that hair?
Same hair.
Wow.
Wow.
You should ask him some secrets for your own.
I will.
All right.
Richard. What's the farthest you've ever ran? Well, for Russ Cook, the answer is 16,000 kilometers. As the extreme marathon runner, he just became the first person ever to run the entire length of Africa. Okay. It took him 352 days. The journey was across 16 countries. It came with an abundance of challenges, including food poisoning, being robbed at gunpoint, but it didn't stop him. He finally made it to the end, where folks flew out to run alongside him to the finish line. Congratulations, Russ.
I wonder,
God bless him.
What do his feet look like?
I don't want to know.
Wow.
He needs a pedicure, I can guarantee it.
Well, that's one way to travel.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I would recommend it, but I would recommend watching us tomorrow. We will be here. Thanks. That's it for us, everybody. Have a great night.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Listen to The Five ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.